Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE, has ended a contract to hold immigrant detainees with Yuba County Jail about an hour north of Sacramento. The termination ends a contract that dates back nearly 30 years, back to 1994. The news is hailed by elected officials and immigration rights advocates as long overdue because of the facility's record of failing to meet ICE inspection standards. Joining us to talk about their reporting on the end of Yuba County Jail's federal contract is Taiki Hendricks, KQED's senior editor for immigration. Good morning, Taiki.
Good morning, Vicky. Pleasure to be here.
Welcome. So this contract dates back to 1994. That's when Yuba County Jail began detaining immigrants for the federal government. Why did this begin?
Well, you know, I mean, as you say in the top, you're saying, you know, it's long overdue, as advocates and elected officials have said. I think it's worth saying, you know, immigrants or anybody who's incarcerated really depends on their jailers for their health and safety. And so, you know, conditions of detention are really important. And ICE does have standards that were not being met at Yuba. How did Yuba get into the business of detaining immigrants for ICE? It does date back to 1994. County jails in other parts of California have also done this. A lot of them have ended. Yuba's the last one to have an ICE contract because other ones had ended working with ICE. But, you know, Yuba, as a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, know, is a rural agricultural county stretching from Marysville there where the Yuba River flows into the Feather River and through farmland and all the way up into the Sierra foothills. This ICE contract was like $6 million for a while. It grew to about $8.5 million this year. And my team at KQED reported a few years ago on the deep relationship with this ICE contract and the way that it really came to support, you know, the sheriff's department budget. And it really was a steady stream of income as the county weathered ups and downs in the economy.
So it was significant not only for the jail, but also for the region, the multi-million dollar contract going back, you know, more than two decades.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of money flowing into a local government in a small rural area.
You also mentioned that Yuba County is now the lone public facility in the state to detain immigrants that are fighting deportation. What were the biggest changes over the last 28 years since this has been whittled down in California?
Well, I think we've seen a growth in private prison companies coming into the you know, immigration detention space, if you will. And counties like Contra Costa, for example, down here in the Bay Area, have said, like, no, we don't want to hold people for ICE anymore, as there's been more public outcry. And indeed, the state of California saying we don't want to be in the business of detaining people for ICE. So this is the end of a public, like a local government, holding ICE detainees in California.
And it's important to make the distinction. These are civil detentions. These are not criminal.
That's a really good point to make. So this is not a punishment for a crime when you're locked up by ICE. It's civil detention that's intended to ensure that you appear for your immigration court hearing. When you are either an asylum seeker, somebody who's newly come into the country and looking to stay here, and you have to make your case through the immigration courts, or if you're even a long-term legal resident who has had trouble with the law and has a criminal conviction, that could end up taking away your green card and making you deportable, and now you're in deportation proceedings. Some people are held, it's a mandatory thing to hold them in ICE detention. But, you know, the advocates will say, look, this is civil detention. Like, it's not necessary as a way to get people to show up in court.
Yeah. And the jail in Yuba County, it has made headlines in recent years for poor conditions on multiple occasions. What were you able to find that took place?
Well, there's, you know, well-documented poor conditions, and you use the word dangerous in the top. I mean, you know, when you're incarcerated, you depend on your jailers for your health and safety. And so inadequate medical treatment, inadequate mental health treatment, not enough access to recreation, overcrowding. These are some of the things that were documented in grand jury reports and with a long-term consent decree where a federal judge put the jail under supervision because it wasn't meeting, you know, basic standards.
Did ICE ever respond or comment on these conditions at the Yuba County Jail? And did that factor into its termination of the contract?
That's a really good question. The jail has failed to meet ICE's own detention standards. They do periodic inspections and they have a checklist of things. And the Yuba County Jail fell short more than, you know, repeatedly. Did that factor into this decision? ICE is not saying that it did. They're saying this was not an effective use of funds to keep people here. You know, we're paying $8.5 million a year for a guaranteed 150 beds every night. And they were not using, you know, they were the right now there's four ICE detainees at the jail. So they're saying it was a, you know, a matter of sort of fiscal prudence. But you can sort of connect the dots also that there's been a lot of outcry and the jail has not even met ICE's own detention standards.
And there has been a public outcry, as you were talking about, not only from immigration advocates, it also included Congress members, but also there were reports even within the facility that there were hunger strikes taking place. There were also lawsuits against COVID-19 violations. Do you think that this played a role in not only highlighting the problems within the jail, but leading to the termination of the contract? Where does that fit into this?
Sure. Well, you know, for people who are locked up, I mean, your ability to sort of get the word out about your conditions is limited. And so there were some protests, there were people waging hunger strikes. And then they were fortunate to have advocates for the civil rights of immigrants on the outside, lawyers filing lawsuits on their behalf. And I think it really did come to a head during the pandemic. When we were seeing, you know, in the days before vaccinations for COVID, people, you know, all over the country have been dying of COVID. When you're locked up, you know, social distancing is hard. Jails and prisons, and including ICE detention and Yuba, have used solitary confinement as a way to separate people. But that, you know, is very isolating and punitive. And there were federal judges who said, no, this is not safe. And no, you can't keep people incarcerated for ICE. And scores of people were released under judges' orders. So I think that kind of brought things to a head. We also had a couple dozen California members of Congress, all Democrats, who led by Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren from San Jose, pushing on ICE to say, you know, this is not safe, this is not okay, you should end these contracts with Yuba and also with some of the other private detention facilities in California. And so I think that pressure, you know, surely played a role.
And this has a direct impact not only on the jail, but also on the sheriff's office, which benefits and uses the nearly 28 years of a federal revenue, multi-million dollar contract. The right. Sheriff Wendell Anderson, you know, he stands by the jail in response to the termination of the contract. He also said that the jail averaged close to 175 detainees, and the number has gradually decreased. As you mentioned, now it's shrank from 175 to four detainees. Why did the population shrink from, you know, kind of that bare minimum of 150 beds that ICE was paying for down to four?
Yeah, well, as I said, that, you know, the pandemic and these judges' orders led to a lot of decarcerating, and it also showed, you know, that these are people who were still making their immigration court hearings, and maybe they didn't have to be locked up. So the Biden administration has been moving more into like alternatives to detention. And so I think they're using that as another way to do this. So, you know, and it's a lot more cost effective. But that has, as you say, you know, left the county without that revenue.
You bring up a really important point that this also hinges on the administration. And so how did these practices change under the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and now the Biden administration?
Sure. Well, I mean, immigration detention has been with us for a long time. You know, it's ramped up over the last couple of decades. And then under President Trump, there was really a wholesale deportation policy that led to massive detention nationally, up to about 55,000 people in ICE detention on the average at the peak. With COVID, that fell way, way down to about 14,000. So a huge drop off. Right now, there are about 30,000 people in ICE detention. So the Biden administration is using more of these alternatives to locking people up, but they are still, you know, holding plenty of people in immigration detention.
And we're talking about public facilities. Yuba County was the lone public facility to house immigrants, but are there other immigration detention facilities that exist in the state? Because you also touched upon how this is kind of shifting to more of a private facility enterprise.
Yeah. In California now, we have only private prison companies, big corporations, the Geo Group, CoreCivic, and another one or two. There are half a dozen ICE jails. They've been used as state prisons at different times and so forth, and these companies sort of repurpose them. They're all in the Central Valley or Southern California.
And as we're learning, it is profitable when you have multi-million dollar contracts with the federal government. Are the conditions at these private run facilities the same, and do they face similar scrutiny as a public facility like Yuba County did?
Yeah, I mean, they certainly have faced a lot of criticism over conditions. And as I said, this group of members of Congress from California have raised concerns about Mesa Verde, Adelanto. There's a whole series of them that have been under scrutiny. And when you are a private corporation, you're answering to your shareholders, and the profit motive is the primary thing. So there could be a lot of cost cutting. I would say under President Obama, the federal system said, we're not going to use private companies for federal prisons, and they moved away from it, but not in terms of ICE detention.
Hmm. We're focusing on California. Is there a larger shift taking place of public facilities losing federal contracts with ICE?
Well, Yuba was the last one for California.
What about that? Do you know if this is happening elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're seeing a trend specifically around the public facilities, but we are seeing the Department of Homeland Security, which is ICE's parent agency, scrutinizing where they're holding people around the country. And they have closed over the last year four or five facilities or terminated contracts with both jails and private prison companies.
Taiki, this is also happening. This contract will be terminated in like February, but this also comes with potentially the end of Title 42, which is expected to end in December as early as this Friday. What kind of impact do you think this will have on immigration enforcement as it continues to evolve?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to have to see, but the people who are held in immigration detention are, as I say, you know, sometimes these newly arrived asylum seekers, and other times they're long-term residents who have had, you know, criminal convictions that make them deportable. We're seeing with the folks who are coming to the border more of these alternatives to detention, electronic ankle monitor that's connected to GPS, a facial recognition, you know, smartphone app or telephonic check-ins where there's a, you know, voice identification. And these things, I mean, pennies on the dollar, they're much less expensive for taxpayers. It's sort of $8 a day on the average, as opposed to $150 a day. And so I think we're going to see more of that for asylum seekers. The Biden administration has brought back a pilot program that the Obama administration used, which was a case management program where there's more like human contact and saying, you know, we're giving you a legal orientation so you understand how the system works and here's where and when you're supposed to show up. And there was like 99% compliance with that. So I think, you know, there's a lot of promise there. But I don't think immigration detention, ICE detention, is going away anytime soon.
We're talking about, you know, when you're talking about the GPS monitoring and it being cost effective and also having this pilot program educating people on the systems of how things work here in the United States, that is, it's practical and there's logistical benefits. But there's also an argument I would imagine advocates would make, immigration advocates, that it's also more humane. Finally, Taiki, do you think that this is part of a larger shift in the change of enforcing immigration?
Well, as you say, I mean, it is more humane, you know, not to be behind bars, to be able to, you know, be living in your community with, you know, your family, your children, be able to go to your job if you're working. And I think very critically, it's much easier to find a lawyer to represent you in immigration court, to build, bring the materials together to build your case. And so people with lawyers have a much, much better chance of, say, winning asylum than those who don't. I think, you know, there's competing pressures in this country and people who are concerned with the civil rights of immigrants, with these due process rights. And at the same time, you know, folks, there's a kind of a fear mongering about immigrants in our society as some kind of a threat. Talking points from Republicans about sort of the uncontrolled border. And so I think I don't know where this is headed. I think we need to keep following it. But you know, there is a strong movement of pressure to say immigrants don't have to be locked up in order to make it to their immigration court hearings.
Taiki, thank you so much for sharing your reporting.
It's my pleasure. Great to talk with you.
Taiki Hendricks is KQED's senior editor for immigration, sharing their reporting on ICE terminating its contract with Yuba County Jail. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. California has set lofty goals in the pursuit of reducing its carbon footprint and minimize the impact of climate change. Part of that effort includes encouraging residents to make this transition in their everyday lives, from buying electric cars, swapping out stoves, and installing solar panels. But for many, the environmental argument for going green may not be convincing enough to make the switch, especially when many of these technologies are financially out of reach. But a new pilot program in Sacramento aims to help low-income homeowners who live in older, gas-reliant houses make the transition free of charge. CAP Radio environment reporter Manola Sakaida joins us to tell us more about the program and share what she learned speaking to Sacramento residents who are taking part in this pilot program and the energy transition. Good morning, Manola.
Morning. Happy to be here.
So let's just start off by explaining what the pilot program is for SMUD and what spearheaded it and what the long-term goals are.
Sure. So the program was launched by SMUD earlier this year. And, you know, it started after a lot of conversations with community organizations. It's a pilot program aimed at transitioning kind of older gas-reliant homes to more efficient, greener appliances. And it's specifically targeted at people who can't really afford those changes on their own. You know, for example, transitioning like a gas stove to an electric stove, you know, not something people might necessarily be able to do on their own, but this program would actually allow them to swap those out for free. So that's the main focus. And right now they're focusing on the Gardenland neighborhood, which is this neighborhood in northern Sacramento, if you haven't heard of it before. And they're planning on expanding to other neighborhoods, but this is kind of where they're starting. And then the really long-term goal here, the overarching goal, is that they want to help low-income people transition to greener appliances, you know, throughout the county. And that would hopefully not only get them closer to their goal. You know, SMUD's own goal is to eliminate carbon emissions from their power supply by 2030. But like you mentioned, California has its own goals in making this transition.
2030 feels like it's right around the corner when you're talking about climate change.
<Right. laughs>
So when it comes to the pilot program, how did SMUD select residents who qualified?
Right. So it's aimed at low-income homes. So there's that kind of financial requirement there. And, you know, getting it started is pretty straightforward. Basically, a resident just makes a call to SMUD. If they think they qualify, they figure that out. And then SMUD sends over a specialist to kind of walk through the home with that resident. And then together, the resident and the SMUD employee will kind of discuss, you know, what could be swapped out in the house, what they want to keep, and just, you know, really start that discussion.
As with most things that are these big, meaty challenges that we face collectively, I mean, there are these intersections at play. So when it comes to going green, there's this intersection of the environment and also equity. And as I think a lot of us know, we may have a desire or an inkling to want to be more energy efficient, but oftentimes it costs a lot of money. So what does this reflect when it comes to the bigger challenges that California is facing in making that transition to greener energy accessible to everyone?
Right. And like you said, this is a conversation that everyone's having all over California. So, you know, on the state level, there's these really big changes that need to happen. California is committed to 100% clean energy by 2045, which is, you know, a pretty big goal. And, you know, more importantly, actually, or more immediately, I should say, is that the state has promised that they'll be 90% of the way to that goal by 2035. So that's even sooner. And then, you know, we've seen some changes towards getting us towards cleaner energy in the state, like the state's mandate that all cars sold here must be electric vehicles by 2035. So there's just, you know, a lot going on when it comes to the goals that California has for cleaner energy in the state. And, you know, that's really going to impact everyone living here, and something we'll all be thinking about for, you know, coming years.
Yeah, there's like more than 40 million of us who call California home. And there's also a lot of research that's devoted to this. What did you learn from people who are researching this issue about what will make this transition successful?
Right. There's, you know, some immediate obstacles, I guess, in these conversations. And one of the first ones, and it's kind of like an instinctive reaction for most people, is the idea that, you know, what if this isn't affordable to me? You know, how am I supposed to, you know, afford this thing that might be affecting a lot of my life?
In a state that is a high cost of living state.
Exactly. So I was curious about that, too. Obviously, there are people that are thinking about the answers to that. So I kind of looked around and I ended up talking to Alan Jen, who's a researcher with UC Davis's Institute of Transportation Studies. And a lot of his research focuses on the switch to electric vehicles, but he also has a lot of these conversations. And basically, he told me that, you know, the conversations he has with people and their questions when they're discussing transitioning to greener energy and technology has a lot to do with these concerns.
There's this question of like, okay, we are transitioning to, let's say, these greener technologies, we're electrifying everything, right? Then, okay, I don't see the sort of necessarily the immediate benefit. And in a lot of cases, these things are more expensive. So you're asking me to spend more money to, I guess, quote unquote, support the cause, right? And so that is a totally valid sort of response to this technology transition.
yeah, basically makes sense that to a lot of people, especially people who don't have the money to just, you know, buy replacements for appliances at home right off the bat, these environmental arguments aren't really, you know, what really makes them want to do it or feel like it's even feasible, right? So he told me that there's something we can do about that and that there's already some efforts to address that part of it.
We think that for this transition to be successful, you know, people have to want to buy into the technology. They have to believe that it's not only worth it in terms of, let's say, making the environment cleaner, but also that it's sort of just better for them. And I think that can happen, right? So with electric vehicles, at the point where the technology is cheaper and the product is like better than a gas car, you know, why wouldn't people make that transition, right? And similarly, you know, for other technologies, like, okay, you want me to switch to an induction stove, or you want me to get rid of my heater and get a heat pump. You know, at the point where these things become more affordable and can perform the services that you want in a way that's better than your conventional technology, then I think that there's no reason why people won't make that switch.
So, you know, the main thing in what he's talking about is making these technologies, you know, actually appealing, you know, mm-hmm. not just an environmental swap, but something that is going to make, you know, their utility bills a little bit easier, just going to overall be a little bit more efficient. And then eventually, you know, even bring some costs down. But, you know, there's other obstacles, especially for the SMUD program, and that had more to do with gaining trust and building a relationship with the people living in the Garden Land neighborhood.
Yeah, there's that big obstacle of getting people to think way into the future of like 2045 when they're just trying to get by every day in California. Mm-hmm. And then there's this more nuanced issue within the city of Sacramento. So let's dive into Garden Land, this neighborhood. What is the obstacle that they had to overcome, and what did you learn about the pilot program?
Right. Yeah. And I talked to some representatives with community organizations in the area to learn about Garden Land and its history and just really understand why, you know, there might be distrust that community members might have with a utility coming in and making changes to their home. And one person I talked to was Julie Broughton. She's the executive director of the Stanford Settlement Neighborhood Center, which is a community organization located in Garden Land. And she told me that this issue isn't unique to the neighborhood and that there's a specific way her organization attempts to work with the community in ways that maybe other organizations might not immediately think to.
So many times for under-resourced neighborhoods, people from the outside come in and want to fix things for the people. And that's not our agency's approach. We try to start on the same level and say, this is what we have. How can we help? What can you do? So I think that there's an equity issue about how any organization or any group or any company comes into a community. First step is you have to get to know that community and you have to understand just a little bit of their history so that if you want to have a big impact, you really need to start where people are at and not talk down, but join with.
And she told me about the neighborhood's history and how distrust might come into play specifically in Garden Land.
Garden Land is one of the oldest communities in Sacramento. The first homes were built out here in 1925. And there's 4 and 5 generations of families still living in some of those houses, which if they were built in 1925, they're probably not up to today's codes. So it's not as simple as just going in and saying, here's a free electric water heater. It's, where is your current water heater? Is it enclosed properly? Do we need to build something to make it possible to install that appliance up to code? It's a really way more complex issue than we're here to provide free stuff.
Yeah, basically what Julie is getting at here is the fact that residents had a lot of concerns about SMUD employees entering their homes and potentially getting them in trouble if parts of their homes weren't up to code for reasons that were really out of their control, you know, whether financially or other reasons.
A lot of homeowners probably don't want an inspector coming by
exactly.
and checking on them. Yeah,
exactly. So these are all conversations that had to happen, you know, even before SMUD launched the program and started, you know, knocking on doors.
So this is really like a new approach, especially with this community organization that you met with about, you know, kind of like avoiding steamrolling into a neighborhood. So how did community members end up having these conversations with SMUD?
Yeah, there was a lot of lead up to the program actually launching. A few community groups came together and asked SMUD actually to meet with the community first before moving the program forward once they learned about it. Those community meetings at the beginning were organized by the Sacramento Environmental Justice Coalition and also the Community Resource Project. And then after that, organizations in Gardenland like Julie's really took on the work of, you know, keeping up with SMUD and letting them know about the neighborhood's history and how they needed to be, you know, sensitive to that history if they wanted their program to work. You know, not even just to have it be well received, but actually for people to want to sign up. So, you know, another person I spoke to about that was Marbella Sala. She's the president of the Gardenland Northgate Neighborhood Association. And she told me that, you know, in these conversations, you know, she and others really told SMUD that residents just wouldn't participate in the program if they thought it would put their housing situation in danger. And that was something that Sala told me that SMUD didn't really have on their radar right away. But they wanted to do something about it. They were receptive. And after more conversation, Sala told me that they came up with an agreement. SMUD won't report anything that they see when they're checking out a home. And that's been the first step to building trust.
The first thing is getting them to trust that SMUD's not going to report them, that there's not going to be any unintended consequences for them coming into their home and doing an assessment. And that's been a little bit of a challenge. But I think as more families can tell their stories to the other families, like, look, it was a good thing. And I got air conditioning when I never had air conditioning. I got new windows. I didn't have to pay, and it was safe, and they were good, and they were respectful, and no one reported me, then others are more trusting and say, okay, that's a good thing, and we want this.
And just for more detail on SMUD's side, they told me that they're not entering homes to report code violations, but, you know, sometimes they can't do work if something in the house related to what they're working on is not up to code. So what they've been doing is, you know, if the utilities employees come across something in a home that's not up to code, their plan is to help make those necessary changes, however possible, because, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's important that the house be safe to live in, but also that SMUD doesn't create bigger problems for the residents.
Yeah, and those community organizations and also word of mouth are just so crucial to building trust. And that liaison is so important for SMUD to work with this neighborhood, Gardenland in Sacramento. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with CAP Radio environment reporter Manola Sakaida about a pilot program in Sacramento helping low-income earners make the green energy transition free of charge. So for this story, you visited Sacramento's Gardenland neighborhood, I would imagine, and you also spoke with residents who qualified for the program. One of the residents you spoke with was Daniel Pruna. What did you learn about Daniel?
Yeah, so Daniel was really sweet. We had a chat with him inside his home. I got to meet his little dog, which was very cute. And for Daniel, you know, he told me that first and foremost, this was a cost-saving thing for him. He'd actually been thinking about this for years. You know, a few years ago, he started installing solar panels in his home with his spouse, and that had already lowered their electricity bills. And then, really sadly, his spouse passed away earlier this year, and, you know, he really struggled with that loss, and it obviously changed parts of his life. And there were some financial concerns for him. But he said that he also qualified for the program this year. And this program has really helped him out in that financial side of things.
I feel like I'm going to be able to afford to retire here comfortably. And I feel like that with the savings, even though my spouse has dearly departed, I don't have to have the fear or the worry of having to rent out a room in order to make ends meet because my electricity bill has gone down and now I won't have a PG&E bill and things are working out for me financially.
So, you know, for him, they've replaced broken fans in his house, you know, fans that have been broken for a long time. They're replacing his fridge with something more efficient. They're getting him LED lights, an electric HVAC unit. And what that means for him is that his house is going all electric and basically cutting out his PG&E gas bill. So with the electric bill, he told me that it's also cutting down those expenses because, you know, overall his appliances are going to be more efficient than before. So he's really, you know, a case of did not come into this with the environmental first mindset, but has really seen a lot of financial benefits.
Yeah, I mean, that's huge. I mean the improvements that were made on his home. Another resident you spoke with was 86-year-old Anindita Daniel. How did you meet her and what stands out to you about her?
Yeah, another really sweet person I got to spend some time with who also had a dog.
I see you like dogs.
Yes. Yeah, a cute chihuahua. I was introduced to her by Jose Medina, and he's one of SMUD's energy specialists. So he was the guy that checked out her home. I visited her home with Jose, and she talked to me about all the changes she's making in her home. And then she also told me that, you know, for her, actually, you know, a lot of it was environmental, and that she kind of knew about some of these environmental benefits before the program. And then in the course of the program and, you know, kind of being educated about some of these swaps in her home, she's learned about some more of those environmental benefits.
Hay muchos beneficios y también para el cambio climático, que quiero repetir porque pues en el aire, en la atmósfera, respiramos las cosas que no están bien ahí. Y la electricidad nos ayuda para no usar otros productos, otras cosas.
And you might have heard her dog barking in the back a little
Chihuahua.
Bit there. But basically what she just said was that, you know, there's a lot of benefits here, especially for climate change, and that she just wanted to emphasize that. And that also, you know, in the atmosphere, you know, there's a lot of things that we breathe in that aren't healthy for us, and that's a product of pollution. So transitioning to electricity, she says, is a part of taking that pollution away from the atmosphere. So that's, you know, kind of what she told me, what she was, her understanding of what was going on. And she also said that, you know, alongside that, and she, you know, she's really excited to be part of that change for future generations. You know, she also did want to have some ownership over what was happening in her own home. So for example, she's getting everything swapped out except for her stove. She wanted to keep her gas stove. And, you know,
it is a big deal, especially, I don't know, in Mexican. I'm half Mexican. In Mexican households, it's a big deal.
I was going to say, and actually, Maria Sala, the community organizer I was talking to before that, mentioned that, you know, a lot of Latino homes specifically want to keep the gas stoves.
It's a big thing.
Exactly. And so being culturally competent and not just steamrolling someone who wants to keep something and really allowing them that space to say, this is what I want, is really, really important, not just in, again, making this happen in a culturally competent way, but getting people to actually want to be part of it and think that or know that their personality will still stay in the home that they live in.
And I mean, the elephant in the room here is that Anindita knew a lot about the benefits of the environment, now receiving the benefits of it and the cost as well, but also communicated what she wanted and did not want to happen to her home. However, she speaks Spanish. And so there's a language barrier here. What did you learn about the role language can play in achieving energy transition?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, luckily I was able to speak to her in Spanish because I speak Spanish. But, you know, one thing she told me is that before this project, she had not spoken to a SMUD person that spoke in Spanish. It would always been an English speaker. She has some family, so I assume that, you know, she's able to speak a little bit of English and then has some family help at times. But she said that this time, you know, she was able to talk to Jose in Spanish, and that really kind of opened up this project to her in a different way. And she told me that, you know, it helped her gain more trust and confidence in the program and its objectives, and that, you know, being able to actually speak to someone in her first language just really was a benefit that she didn't even know she could have. And again, is something that SMUD has been trying to improve in this program, you know, coming to people in the languages that they speak and really trying to make sure that trust is built in that way.
Yeah, meeting people where they are, that's a huge ingredient to building
trust.
Finally, Manol, in the last 30 seconds or so that we have, I mean, this isn't only about money, it's also a cultural shift. What did you learn about that?
Right. So, you know, everything we're getting at is, you know, getting at the idea that we need to make this transition, definitely, but we also need to know about the history of communities, their needs, and we have to really collaborate with them and not just tell them, you know, this is the point that we need to make. This is what we need to do without their participation. And, you know, for SMUD, that means that progress has been slower. And they've said that to me. It's slower than they anticipated. But the point is that if you're working with community, it's going to take a little bit more time. But in the long run, it's going to be, you know, a better relationship with them. And it's going to be, there's going to be more trust so that this actually becomes a widespread phenomenon that's really adopted by people.
Manola, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Manola Sakaita is Cap Radio's environment reporter. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Crocker Art Museum's next exhibit is an iconic catwalk of sorts, showcasing runway creations and intimate behind-the-scenes photos of the late fashion designer Alexander McQueen. William Breziel is a curator of art at Crocker Art Museum and joins us with a little taste of the Lee Alexander McQueen and Anne Ray exhibit, which debuts this weekend. Good morning, William.
Good morning. Good morning.
So the museum Crocker reached out a couple months ago about this exhibit, letting us know. So this seems like it's a pretty big deal.
You know, it really is. It's the first exhibition that we've done that includes fashion objects as well as photographs. And that's something that's actually really perfect for us. We've had a lot to do with photographs in the past, and this unique relationship between Lee Alexander McQueen and Anne Ray is something that the exhibition explores.
For those who are unfamiliar with Lee Alexander McQueen, who was he? A little bit of a background.
Yes. Well, Alexander McQueen is his sort of usual name. He was Lee to his friends. He was a sort of troubled genius. He was a transformative fashion designer. He created ways of looking at fashion objects, at garments, that's really a unique and sort of new thing that happened in the 90s.
And he was involved in more than fashion, correct, as an artist and a creative?
Yes. He was trained at Central St. Martin's, which is the sort of very famous London school for fashion and a whole lot of other things. He's a man who knew his art history. He knew his fashion history, and he included those things in his collections as well.
How did he come to meet photographer Anne Ray?
She had trained at St. Martin's as well, and they met in 1997. She had been working in Tokyo photographing for Givenchy and Cartier, and they met. And when they met, there's a sort of wonderful quote that happens. He said to her, "I love your photographs, but I'm broke." so You give me your photographs and I'll give you clothes. So this exhibition documents that 13-year-long collaboration, including some of the fashion objects that he gave her, as well as photographs that she took.
Lead with the compliment, close with the challenge, and then end with some kind of negotiation.
Right, exactly.
And it led to a relationship that spanned over a decade, especially with these photos. We're going to get to the runway designs in just a moment. But what stands out to you about these behind-the-scene photographs?
They provide a look into a world that is very, very seldom seen. There are photographs that show the workshop, so the act of creation happening. And I personally find that very exciting. Mm-hmm. There are also photographs of people sort of adjusting things just before the runway moment. So this is a world that Alexander McQueen generally sort of kept private from nearly everyone else except for Henri. So that's something that makes the photographs really unique.
That's what stood out to me, too, is this creative collaboration of what I really appreciated was this glimpse, this fly on the wall moment of the precision and the detail down to the very last moment.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And one thing about McQueen is that he's such a craftsman. He trained on Savile Row, which is for London menswear. It's the sort of cathedral of London menswear, if you want. And he learned construction, craftsmanship, all those things very, very well. And to be able to see part of that happening, it's really exciting.
So let's dive into the craftsman part of Alexander McQueen and these runway creations. There are dozens that we can experience starting this weekend. What are the highlights?
Well, you know, it's actually there are the exhibition begins with not only photographs, of course, but also some of those some of the creations that were made for Henri by McQueen. So that's where we begin. So that's really sort of talking about that collaboration. And then as you move on through the exhibition, then you end up with a sort of career-long survey, really, of his work up until 2010.
For those who don't have a design background, a fashion layman like myself, what advice do you have on the themes and the details to look out for when you take in the exhibit?
You know, I think one of the things that's most important is to look at materials. There's horsehair, there's beads, there's all sorts of different fabrics that are played with in different ways. So there's everything from a sort of woolen houndstooth to a taffeta to, you know, pleated silk, all of these things that are used in really, really interesting ways.
There's also an interactive component as well for people who visit. So talk to us about the adjoining exhibition, which is the McQueen Dressing Room Experience.
Yes, yes. There is is a sort of space where people can sort of explore some of the same things, actually.
Get the creative juices flowing.
Yes. Explore materials, explore process of design, explore the runway. There actually is a sort of runway that's set up. And then also there's opportunity for photography as well to get that that experience in there.
That's so cool. And it's just, I think it's another, it takes it to another level when you can try your hand in embroidery. You also have exploring patterns and fabrics, as you mentioned, even taking a photo on the runway. But there's also like a lot of pieces that are currently getting into place right now. This is kind of like the 11th hour for the museum for this exhibit because this debuts on Saturday. So can you give us your own behind the scenes look at all the work and the coordination that's going on right now?
Well, you know, this installation actually started last Monday, so it's sort of longer installation than usual, of course, because not only do you have to deal with the fashion objects themselves, but then not only placement, but also all of the details, making sure that the construction, all of that is comprehensible to the viewer. So to do that, we had three people sort of in charge of dealing with the fashion objects. And so there's been a lot of sort of figuring out where things go, how they interact, and then also showing this, you know, adjusting mm-hmm. to show construction and materials in ways that are, you know, so that's been part of it. Then also the photographs, some of which are actually very, very large and very impactful. And there's what we've tried to create is a balance between those two things, the sort of impact of the fashion objects and then the impact of the photographs.
Finally, William, I remember interviewing Crocker Art Museum back in 2020 during the pandemic, just the impact on arts and culture in our area. And I was so interested to learn that these exhibits can be planned years in advance. And the pandemic created kind of a logjam in logistics because they're rotating exhibits from one city to another. How is that looking now? Has all of that been ironed out?
The pandemic, of course, sort of it meant that there were exhibitions that the public was not able to see during that time. We had an exhibition, for example, that sort of opened just before the pandemic. And then at the end of, you know, as the museum was able to be open, that same exhibition was able to be viewed for another little bit of time. But at this point, yes, we are back to our normal schedule in terms of sort of getting things together and all of that. Yes.
That is wonderful to hear. William, thank you for making the trip. It's nice to see you.
Oh, delighted to be here. Thank you so much.
William Breeziel is a curator of art at Crocker Art Museum in Sacramento, giving us a taste of the Lee Alexander McQueen and Anne Ray exhibit, which is debuting this weekend and runs through next year. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.